happening now. We'd like to welcome our viewers from across North America and around the world. You're listening to the EdTech Situation Room, episode 287 for March 29th, 2023. My name is Wes Fryer, and I'm coming to you from Matthews, North Carolina, where it is not snowing outside, but I just love this virtual background. So maybe it's going to snow here year round. I am the middle school innovation teacher teaching robotics, media literacy, and engineering this semester at Providence Day School. And joining me as always is the nerd of the North, where it very well could be snowing because I think the snow just kind of sticks around for a long time. At least that's a rumor I heard. But your books have depleted, Jason. Did you have a theft or a burglary?
No, they're all still there.
Oh, they're there.
Yeah. In fact, they've got a couple more because I stupidly bought two more last week that who knows when I'll have time to read. But yes, greetings from Missoula, Montana, where it's actually raining right now, but it's been rain snow mix for, well, we had a huge dump of snow over the weekend. In fact, Bozeman, Montana, which is about a 3-hour drive from here, got 3 feet of snow over the weekend. We had a foot that melted pretty quickly, although it just turned into kind of an ice hat on top of my car. So that was a good time on Monday morning trying to get to work. But yes, spring is hopefully here soon. I would say maybe a little unhappy that the spring is not sooner here. And I was in Tacoma last week for the Northwest Council for Computer Education Conference, and it was kind of windy and rainy there, but warmer, and it's like, oh, I could use a little warmth in my life, for sure.
Yes, yes. Well, I mowed the grass in shorts and a t-shirt today. I think it was like 61, but we actually hit 85, maybe?
Oh, wow.
Did we hit up that high? It was, anyway, it's been in the 70s. It's nice. We're in the Piedmont, which is this area between the mountains of and the coast. So it is, it's nice amount of weather. Well, I heard that you, basically a grand slam is 4 runs. And I think you had like 10 that you hit at this keynote. That's what I heard. So what's a 10 run grand slam, whatever that is.
Yeah, maybe a walk-off home run. I know just enough about baseball to know what that is. It was a really good speech. I told some of people that I really needed like 39 out of 39 little things to come together to make it happen. And in fact, part of Dr. Fryer and I's background in speech is we're both former forensic competitors. So we've done speech and debate events in both high school and college, and I don't do scripted speeches. It's just not been my thing. I've done maybe 3 or 4. In fact, I was just remembering that the first year I did the K-12 online conference back in the day, which was one of our early opportunities to work together, I did do a scripted one year because I was just nervous about doing something for that group. It was my first exposure kind of outside the state of Montana, and I really wanted to go well, but it took me days to write the script, and I just don't have days to do really anything of that level. So the rest of those that I did was off the cuff, but it wasn't, you know, completely impromptu. I wasn't just given a topic and told to go, although I can speak in that way. I had been working on this for about 4 months, and slides are useful to me. I don't read off of them. In fact, I don't think there were many words. In fact, now that I think about it, I don't think there was any words on my slides other than some titles to parts of my presentation, but they were all really image driven. But yeah, it was an extemporaneous speech for sure. And what I would say is that I did do a practice the day before. It was terrible, but my practices are always terrible because there's no audience. There's nothing to feed off of. There's no laughter. There's no a shock, which is something I feed off of a lot as a speaker. And yeah, it went extremely well. I got to tell a very personal story that I think has pertinence to teachers. And I was excited that it went off so well. So I'm very thankful for the wonderful audience in Tacoma. I'm also very thankful of the wonderful NCC organization that gave me this chance to tell my story.
Well, we want to let folks know that if you happen to be in any kind of educational technology organization or conference, Dr. Neifer is available to share that keynote. And I was remiss that I was unable to travel there, but I didn't think any PD would be in the cards, and I was actually able to go to Raleigh to our state ed tech conference. So anyway, it was good to be able to get in on some, but hopefully, sir, we can find a way for me to meander up to the Mountain Moot, or there's an AI conference that MIT is going to be having in the beginning of May. I doubt we'll probably hit that one, but you know, hopefully Google I/O, we'll just have to see. Well, what are we going to talk about? Hey, it's 2 weeks in a row. I think we kind of had a record of postponements and cancellations there for a while. So it's great to have two in a row. What are we going to do with this massive list of links that you have done the yeoman's work on this time?
Well, we've been, as we do throughout the week, scout the internet for interesting news about technology and kind of shoot it through an educational prism. If you're interested in seeing some of our source material, the place to go is our website at techsr.com/links, where you can see really every link we've talked about over the last, was this 4 or 5 years, 6 years we've been doing the podcast. And sometimes we have breaks, but have generally been pretty consistent week to week in providing an episode. And if you want to go all the way back, we actually have our old document too, where you can see things going back to episode one. And if you are a podcast nerd and like the kind of evolution that's happening with podcasts, you can go back and see what our very early documents look like, where we were talking about three links a week or part of that. And you know, we are obviously much more extensive now. So looking back at our original doc here, our first episode was January 27th, 2016. So wow. We have now been doing this for, that's 7 years, right? We've been doing that, or 6 years? Yeah.
Look at that. We had 10 links. Oh my gosh.
So wow. Yeah, we're happy to be here. But this week our topics include, and of course now I got down this rabbit hole to get back to my main page, tech correction, which will be mostly dominated by the proposed TikTok ban this week. Some information that we didn't get to last week on Section 230. The weekly AI rabbit hole is open, so we will probably jump down that and see where it leads us. Some hardware news, some sad hardware news, actually, some copyright intellectual property news, consumer rights news, privacy, Google, miscellaneous, and then we'll end our podcast tonight with our so-called Geek of the Week. Dr. Fryer, where shall we start tonight?
Can you please start with the Internet Archive article? Because I am maybe going to be just, you know, tearful and emotional in hearing decision, I guess, by this court.
Yeah, so we reported on this last week that there was a lawsuit in play that four traditional publishers have sued the Internet Archive, saying their website does not have the right to scan books and lend them out like a library. And Judge John G. Cotel said the Internet Archive had done nothing more than create derivative works, and so would need authorization from the book's copyright holders, the publishers, before lending them out through the National Emergency Library Program. The Internet Archive says it's going to appeal. But they also think that it's really a blow to the library model in general. And there's been actually a long history to this. The last time I read an in-depth article about this, that the notion of a library and what it's able to do and what it's not able to do goes back decades and decades and decades. This is not a new phenomenon at all. And it's one of the reasons why some libraries, and I know this is true of school libraries, for example, sometimes have to pay astronomical prices for books that have lending rights attached to them. And there's been a lot of back and forth about this, but there is a lot of case law around this notion that a library, you know, has certain rights to be able to purchase or acquire a work and then make it part of its lending library so that people can, you know, share the resource. But that hasn't always been, you know, entirely clear. And basically, the Internet Archive, which has both been scanning books themselves, also been working with libraries that scan books, and they took the massive book preservation project from Google Books and made that a part of its library. And what you can do is essentially go there. Not every book is available there. It's most popular books are not, but for a lot of books, that really have no commercial value anymore, you can go to the Internet Lending Library at archive.org and essentially check out a book for an hour or more, be able to page through it on an interface. There's not a limit of an hour. If you have a verified visual deficiency or a disability that means it renders that, available to you for longer periods of time. And it really has transformed, especially works that are no longer copyrighted. And I mentioned last week that, as an example of this, my wife and I recently completed a very long planned project that was only really available to us because we stopped traveling during the pandemic, but we completely gutted our kitchen and started over again with new fixtures, new appliances, and we were so excited. The project took nearly 3 months to complete. We were without a kitchen for 3 months. And we, kind of entered a renaissance of cooking over the last couple of months. And I love old community cookbooks. I love old church cookbooks. I love old, nonprofit organizations that put out cookbooks, junior leagues across the United States put out wonderful cookbooks, all the time. And in a lot of them, they have great kind of old fashioned Americana recipes that was the kind of food I grew up on. A lot of those cookbooks were in my house growing up. And I just really, really love the whole model. And so, for example, I've probably pulled and saved at least 100 recipes, from that I've used to cook interesting and fun stuff inside my house. So, It is highly disappointing. They are going to appeal the decision. And this is also not the first time that lower courts have ruled against libraries and for publishers. So this is part of a longstanding piece. So it's not quite a done deal by any stretch of the imagination, but certainly disappointing that that the district court judge in the Southern District of New York voted against or ruled against the Internet Archive.
So depending upon your situation, this may or may not be directly applicable, but this idea of being able to take a work that you own and then change the format of it, but not loan any additional copies beyond what you've already purchased and licensed, is kind of a key idea in terms of digitization. It has been. When I was at Texas Tech in the early 2000s, we had a pretty extensive VHS collection. And not very many VHS players. And so at that time, we were taking, and this is the folks in the technology department, got this special, VHS to DVD converter. It was in the process of making all of those VHS tapes into DVDs. Again, not to put them online, not to, even check out more copies than we had, but it was simply a format issue. And so if the legal theory of this case would become more generalized, then apparently, libraries, schools, educational institutions, just about anybody, would have to basically buy the new digital copy instead of switching the format. On a personal standpoint, we at one point I had lots of CDs. I was one of those people that had joined a CD club in college. What was that called? BMG. And you got so many free, and then collect them, and then we'd have friends and you'd borrow them, and I'd love to make mixtapes and all this. But at some point when MP3s came about, I was ripping my songs when the iPod was there. Wow, 1,000 songs in your pocket. I was ripping my own DVDs and making those into MP3s and then putting them on my player. And I had an iRiver and some other devices too. And so anyway, that again flows from this whole same idea that, hey, I bought it, but I'm just changing the format. And so with this judge saying, no, this is a derivative work and you've got to go pay for that, that is a significant departure from copyright and intellectual property laws that's been interpreted in our country. And so there's impacts potentially for institutions, with streaming music and Spotify. And you're a Spotify user, by the way. I'm going to digress for a second. Have you tried the Spotify AI DJ?
I have actually, and it needs some work. And my guess is that this is, I've used this term 100 times in the last 6 weeks. This is the worst version it's ever going to be. So it's not great yet, but it's getting there. And, It's a brilliant implementation of this technology, right?
Yeah. Because it's target on, and it'll be interesting. And I'm going to guess that we'll be able to choose a DJ voice at some point, you know, just kind of like you can choose what voice they have. The DJ is not really, when it's trying to suggest stuff to me, it's kind of in left field mostly.
Yeah, but, that's my experience too. And I listen to mostly instrumental music during the day at work. In fact, I have a 4 or 5 playlists that depending on if I need to be super productive or not, or if I'm super focused or the kind of work I'm doing, I have these, you know, 4 or 5 playlists. I'm a huge fan of the composer Philip Glass, and he has a couple soundtracks that are kind of my, for lack of a better way of putting it, my, my productivity list, basically. Like it's my go-to. So when I put on the virtual DJ, the first thing it told me was that, hey, these are some songs that you were super into last summer, but you haven't listened to lately. And I was like, oh, that's great. That's super cool. And then the next one is that you seem to be super into classical music. So here's some top editor's recommendations of classical music. It's like, well, I am, but like, I'm guessing that one of the advancements here is you telling the DJ what you're looking for, right?
Yeah.
Like, I'm looking for some morning music with a beat to it. And that's going to be different than maybe what I listen to in the afternoon, that sort of thing.
And being able to sandbox your preferences. Yeah. I love the Hard Fork podcast now by the New York Times, and Casey Newton, Kevin Ruse do that. And Casey Newton talked about, I think in the latest episode, having challenges. I think it was him with digital hygiene when it came to his Spotify, because he'll put on music when he goes to sleep and it'll play, you know, relaxing music for like, you know, 6 or 8 hours or whatever. And that just totally skews, you know, sort of his listening graph or whatever in terms of, and this is some music you love, but it's not recognizing that, hey, that's, you know, when you're sleeping. And I guess I can go ahead and preview this. I am going to write a post about this. But I have, my post is going to basically be taking back my YouTube, or taking back YouTube, because this fits into this whole idea of what do you watch? What do you listen to? How do you train the algorithm? And so for a number of months, I have been interested in, and it's been probably longer than that, actually, like emergency preparation, prepper stuff. And then I've also watched a number of videos that are like, you know, they're firearms related. And so my YouTube got completely taken over, where there was like nothing else. And so thankfully, and this is the media literacy lesson from this, you know, by deleting things from your watch history, by unsubscribing, I was able to, you know, very quickly, like within, you know, a day, convince YouTube, hey, I don't want to see any of that stuff. I created a separate Gmail account, and then I subscribe to these channels. And when I want to go see some of that stuff, I'm over there. But I think that's a really interesting thing, because when you have eclectic interests, you know, these tools are not at this point refined enough in terms of their main feed algorithm to be able to say, oh, okay, you're interested in looking at cooking stuff now or whatever. I mean, now I'm back to cooking and ChatGPT and, you know, a lot of other things, because YouTube's discovery engine has been phenomenal for me, and it still is, but I completely had lost that. And I was like, this is crazy. I've got to do something. And again, my good news is that it was possible to, you know, in fairly short order, but it took a while. You know, I had to unsubscribe from all those, because I'm kind of crazy about liking videos, and, you know, it just, you're training the machine, not only with the things that you were actually listening to or watching to, but the interactions that you're having with content. So anyway, it'll be interesting to see how that's going to evolve. And yes, that's a pretty nice thing to think about. Hey, it's the worst version we're going to have, so just better from here.
Yep. Hopefully so.
Okay. So, hey, that was a long talk of the Internet Archive. What do you want to do next?
Well, let's just have a moment of sympathy. Intel co-founder Gordon Moore died last week. He is the creator of Moore's Law, which I know, Wes, you talk about a lot. You want to talk about Moore's Law for a second?
Sure. I mean, Moore's Law is this idea that every 18 months we were having a doubling in basically computer capacity. And so that was processors for a while. And there's been all these forecasts of Moore's Law ending, but then it was, you know, continuing. And even though processor, you know, chips and things like that, and I think that had to do with size and nanometers and, you know, different, you know, kinds of hardware, we've still had this incredible exponential, not linear, but exponential or logarithmic increase in computing capacity. And that's been a huge driver of what we've seen with the internet revolution. So Gordon Moore, longtime really guru of I would say futurism and the revolution of computers, the co-founder of Intel, lived a very long and hopefully rich life, passing away at age 94, but he is a luminary in thinking about the ways in which technology influences our lives. And I would predict that most of us who are going to continue to study and work in educational technology will continue to refer to Moore's Law as something that has been pretty important and an important lens to use as we're trying to understand just how crazy fast these changes are and what's driving them.
Yeah. And I would say that there is always, well, at least there has been for the last 15, 20 years, the notion that Moore's Law had slowed down in some way, shape, or form. But I think what has happened in the last 3 years with Apple and their release of Apple Silicon and their own chips, I mean, those were monumentally better than the Intel chips they replaced, which is a bit of irony in light of where Mr. Moore, you know, spent his professional career. But it does, I think, show, you know, that there's still a lot to come. And my guess is too, is that as new architectures take off, like the ARM architecture, at some point will likely be probably the preferred chip, on most desktop and laptop devices, that's likely to help, you know, perpetuate all this moving forward. So all that seems very much in line with what he estimated.
And in terms of trajectories and trends and things like that, you know, there's a couple there that they're sort of latent inside what we were just talking about, the whole mobile revolution and the ways in which mobile chips and mobile technology has influenced the mainstream and, you know, helped us with battery life and how long our devices can be used. But also, in addition to that, oh gosh, what was I going to say? My dog is making so much noise. And Rosie. Anyway. All right. Wes just totally dropped the idea. I know you're a sweet girl, but you're distracting me. That may be a first. Here, she's going to bring me her bone. That's so sweet. There was something else that was a trend line. In terms of chips, you know, Jason at one time was Mr. Android and actually, you know, helped convince me for 9 months to use an Android phone. But we're both very much in the Apple camp. And what we've seen and Google has realized it along with other companies, I think, is there's such a range of benefit when you have a tight integration between hardware and software. And yeah. So Apple coming out with the M1 and M2 processors and, you know, just manufacturing their own chips has been huge in terms of innovation and driving the marketplace and also just kind of setting, I think, well, this is said as a real Apple fanboy, but setting the standard for what, you know, you're going to want in terms of integration, right? My Apple Watch with my phone, with my iPad and my laptop and my continuity and, you know, all these good things. Hey, how about the FTC gym and cable subscriptions? Do you want to hit that one?
Yeah. So this is interesting because this is something that started around the State of the Union time. And it's not a real shock if you are following politics that it's clear that President Biden is going to run for re-election. And I know it's a longstanding thing. Well, this goes back probably 40 years that in addition to big things, small things matter to voters, right? And if you can see a direct impact of the federal government in your day-to-day life, you're much more likely to keep both your member of Congress and the president of the United States in office at the time. So the FTC has proposed a new set of rules that basically make subscriptions basically eliminates the practice of companies to allow you to easily start subscriptions but then make them difficult to stop. And they are calling the new set of rules click to cancel. And essentially, it says that you should be able to first cancel a subscription to anything in the same method you subscribe. So in other words, if you subscribe via app, for example, by signing up in the app, you shouldn't have to call a 1-800 number or send a postcard or write an email or telepathically contact the company to be able to cancel that. And there is a ton of businesses that rely very heavily on the notion it should be easier to start something than stop something. And it's been maybe even a decade or more since I last saw this statistic, but the amount of money that the fitness industry gets via gyms for people who are inactive, it's a majority of the profit for sure, if not a majority of the income comes from, those individuals. And I've been a party to that as well. And, I will tell you that, my own parents have been victims of this in that, trying to, cancel something, like a cable subscription or a newspaper subscription, and the agents that are there to stop you, maybe upsell you or give you a temporary cheaper price, in trying to keep their customer, can sometimes turn into a real barrier to canceling. And so I think this is great news. And I, especially now that I don't know the number of subscriptions I have, my guess is it's got to be in the dozens, between streaming services and individual internet services. In fact, my wife and I about once a quarter now go through our credit card statement and make sure we know what all the things are we subscribe to because of this phenomenon.
And your Patreon subscriptions too, or Patreon, support, which is awesome. The worst one I had with that, was a email to fax. And I was kind of in a desperate spot where I had to get a fax to somebody, and I don't remember what it was legal wise or whatever. And there are these services, but quick online setup, take your debit card, credit card. But when you wanted to unsubscribe, no way to do it electronically, had to call the number, had to talk to the person, and it wasn't really quick. And it was just like, that's when I realized that this is an actual business model and it must be, lucrative because, anyway, that I'm glad to see that too. So.
Yep, absolutely.
All right. Well, so anywhere else before we jump into the AI rabbit hole?
Let me give you a couple other kind of quick ones here. These are all Google related. The first one is that Google has announced that they are launching something called a new Ads Transparency Center. And I think this is really interesting from the standpoint of, I can't imagine this is going to change broad behaviors, but under the notion that we get bombarded with a shocking amount of advertisement that I don't think we're really understanding or really ready for. I think there's utility in companies like Google that are essentially advertising companies, right? Like, Google makes its money via ads, as does, every other social media platform that's quote unquote free. They now have an enhanced ad center. And so if you go to myadcenter.google.com, it's going to give you a lot of information about how you're being tracked and ads you've recently seen. And I love it because, it does show me, why I'm getting various advertisements. And so, it shows you the recent ads that have come from Google. It also tells me my ad topics, and most of these are pretty legitimate. I'll give you an example of my most seen ads are phone plans, laptop computers, mobile phones and accessories, web development and design, gifts, household cleaning products, clothing, kitchen and dining, home appliances, photo software. I'm trying to think if there's anything truly embarrassing on here, which it doesn't look like there is, which is a good sign that my targeted ads are good targeted ads, right? You can even see, there's a sensitive tab. Okay, I'm willing to talk about these. So the sensitive tab, you limit ads on these topics. We do our best not to show you these ads when you're signing into your Google account, YouTube, or Discover. So the five sets of ads that I get that are sensitive ads, and it looks like three of the five of these I turned off. I don't remember turning them off, but I turned them off. One of them is alcohol, which I've limited. Dating, which I've limited, not in the market. Gambling, I've limited. I have allowed pregnancy and parenting, although that ship has sailed, and weight loss, of all things. So I'm not exactly sure. I can't remember the last time I bought a weight loss product per se. I'm happy with my stout stance in the world, but that's very interesting. And then you can also go and see the brands that are targeted towards you. And the most seen ads include Samsung, Amazon.com, Lodge, which makes cast iron. I'm a big cast iron guy. That's not a surprise. Apple, Lenovo, Intel, Monoprice, Logitech, Le Creuset, T-Mobile, Hoover. Like I guess maybe appliances, Sennheiser, which makes audio equipment, iRobot, Verizon, Telo, Mobile, OXO, which makes kitchen equipment, Microsoft, TSA, Paul Smith. I don't know if that's a brand name or a dude. But those are all, and none of these are a surprise to me. So that they all kind of go with my overall shtick. But, you know, I think it's important to put tools like this in consumers' hands, even if you don't really want to see this, but also, eliminating these. I think it's also, if I don't want to see an ad from someone, I should be able to say in this day and age, I don't want to see an ad from this folks. And you can just go on here and, you know, delete an ad. So if I don't want to see, I'm trying to think of something on here. I don't know who Paul Smith is, so I'm going to delete it. So now I've said, got it. You should see fewer ads from this brand soon. That's great.
Man, this is absolutely fascinating. And one thing, okay, I'm on the brands, and the top one is Honda, which is really weird, but right below it is Amazon. My elderly neighbor has had some health issues, and I'm mowing his yard, and he's loaning me his mower. So today I mowed his grass, and I mowed ours, and I had trouble starting it, and so I just ordered on my phone right there, a new whatever, I don't even know what it's called. Basically, it's the string that you're going to pull to start the mower, and it's for a Honda. That's wild. That's the only thing in interaction I can think of that I've had with Honda. So I order from Honda, buy that on Amazon, and now that immediately appears as my most recent top brands that I want to interact with. So this is great visibility, a little visibility into this vast opaque cloud that we've talked about before. I wonder why Epic Games is on here, because I'm not a gamer. CCH is, I'm Googling some of these. DJI, Church's Texas Chicken. Yeah. That's one of my top brands, baby. And then I'm under topics, radio controlled toys and accessories, standardized and admission tests. I mean, come on, seriously? Language education, man. But you know, there's all these, when you move to a new place, it's interesting because you become aware of a lot of things and the ways that we signal, you know, like I made another little Cook with Wes video, this weekend. I wore one of my Philmont Scout Ranch shirts. I'm kind of cognizant a little bit of what I had my Yellowstone hat on, baby. I was looking like an outdoor guy. It's so, so interesting though, because digitally, when we interact with everything, with our phone, with our laptops, with our tablets, any of this, we signal and the machine is listening. So I think this is extremely powerful. I think it would be very interesting because I don't think Google Apps is supposed to be doing anything with respect to student advertising. So if students, and I may have one of my kids do this, tomorrow is go to myadcenter.google.com and see what it says, because it, I don't think they should be advertised and marketed to as part of Google Apps. In fact, the whole ad center is probably just blocked. It probably doesn't even work for them.
I didn't even think about Wes going to my work account, but I do go to myadcenter.google.com, and what it takes me is I don't even know how to respond to this. So I went to it and it said, "Welcome to MyAdCenter, a place for teens and kids to learn about ads. Google doesn't show personalized ads to anyone under 18. Why am I seeing this? You let us know that you're under 18. You can review and adjust your settings at any time." So I'm wondering if it just, because it is a Google education account, that it's also not personalizing to me as an adult.
Well, do you know what happened? And this happened when I shifted out of tech director and, you know, talking to our new tech director. Google made a change, and this was either last summer, but I think it was the summer before last, because I think it was the year before I left Cassidy, that you had to go in and specify which of your users were over, I don't know if it was over 18 or just over 13. But that was something that the Google admin had to do. So if your account, and I think it defaulted to saying everybody was a kid under 13. So, because you have Google admin powers, don't you, for your organization?
Yeah.
So go in and check that out. But I think that you need, well, the capability exists, and it probably would be beneficial to do, to tag, because I think for YouTube and for other kinds of things and content, there's for default settings and everything like that, you basically designate who are adults and who are not. And I think that the default, if you don't go in there and set it, is everyone's a kid. So pretty interesting. But I think this is absolutely wonderful. This gives a greater level of visibility into this opaque world of, the attention economy, the ways in which a vast opaque cloud of data is continually being built all around us based on the ways that we signal, what we talk about, what we order, the web pages we visit, the things we click on, cookies, all that kind of stuff. But I think this is great. I like the fact that you can, you know, turn off or on, you know, these quote sensitive things. I think it's fascinating that it is, you know, letting you see, you know, brands and topics. You can sort those by name, ascending, descending, most recent, or most seen. Interesting. My most seen is Cuisinart. I don't even know what DJI is. I think it's an audio program. Honda.
Well, it's also super interesting because you and I are not that far apart on our interests, right? We're both into cooking and we're both nerds, right? So, you know, and this would be, frankly, a really interesting exercise to do with your significant other too, or your kids for that matter, right? But, because they're not supposed to be targeting younger folks. But yeah, I think this is, I mean, I know that I shouldn't trust Google, right? Like implicitly trust them with everything in, you know, in all the age and time. But what I would say though is that I think it's these kinds of things that really increase the trust I would have, right? And, you know, you can dig deeply into Facebook and find some of this data, but I think putting this on one page for you to access is an incredibly important part of being a trusted partner, is what I would say to the world. So yeah, I'm very impressed with this.
And what's also wonderful is that you've got ways that you can interact with this. Like I am not really caring about Birkenstock or, I mean, yes, I do like fried chicken. That's weird though. You know, I went with a friend and bought Church's chicken last week on like Thursday. So here it is.
Yep.
You know, this is one of the things people are saying, wait, my phone's listening to me. Well, it may just be that you, you know, search for something, you bought something. Man, it also is not comprehensive because when you change the sort order, so I went from most recent to most seen, I saw different things, but it doesn't let you scroll through page upon page. So you're not seeing an exhaustive list. Gardner's Supply Company. What the heck is that? Huh. Fascinating.
Yep.
Well,
I think, so
I think that Well, number one, when Brian Turnbaugh and I back in 2019 were contemplating, you know, what eventually became the Fruit Loop conspiracy theory unit, and, you know, look, studying the moon landings and grappling with conspiracy theories, we were talking about how, you know, search results and the feeds that we see on social media sites, even on Google, but certainly on, well, you know, Facebook, YouTube, are very different and customized. One of the things we need to be wary of if we're in, I would not do this with my middle schoolers, but teaching high school or adults or professional development. If we, you know, require or ask people, search for this on YouTube, you know, search for this, you can actually be signaling then, you know, an interest in this, and that becomes part of your digital footprint, et cetera. I have been using incognito mode more with my students, because we actually check our Google sites to make sure the content that's been embedded there is viewable by everyone, because you can't tell when you're logged in with your own account. But I really, really like having that conversation. Hey, does this mean no one can see what you're doing? No, the IT, you know, the folks we're buying internet from can see it. Our technology department can see it. But this, you know, because it's interesting teaching media literacy and asking kids to do things with their tech. If we're asking them to search for something, you know, if they're not doing incognito, it's going to become part of their search history, you know, and it's not like that's going to be a fatal thing, but it's just, this is all fascinating, and it's learning about how technology works, right? This is providing, this ad center provides a window into how the attention economy is working. And I know, you know, we're going to probably get to some of it, because we're still have about 15 minutes left, but you know, this is how the world of social media is financed. It's through this kind of targeted advertising, and this has implications for politics and elections and all other kinds of things too. So yay, kudos for Google for doing this. Are there going to be many folks that are going to explore this and utilize it? I don't know, but hey, EdTech Situation Room listeners, if you end up checking out your ad center, let us know. What you find out.
Yep.
It says I love basketball. I really don't.
I would like to just do a couple quick hits here. Some other interesting Google news that's going on. 9to5 Google reported yesterday that Chrome OS and the desktop Chrome browser are getting a reading mode, which is awesome for those of you that are on Android phones. And I think this exists in the iOS version of Chrome as well. But essentially, reading mode takes all of the kind of cruft off of a page and gives you just the text. And it's great, especially in the era where ads are becoming more intrusive and, you know, there are technical and sometimes some ethical challenges with ad blockers. Right now, I use a great plugin that is the PostScript. I'm trying to remember the name of it. Oh, the Post Light Reader, excuse me, which is a Chrome plugin that essentially does the same thing and then adds a functionality where I can send the results to my Kindle if I want to set that up. That's kind of nice. But that's a really exciting feature that's coming soon to a Chrome browser. I still think that there are interesting alternatives to the Chrome browser. I've been playing with one lately called Arc that I like, that kind of re-envisions web browsing a bit and also acknowledges that the web can be a very distracting place if you keep a lot of windows open. But I'm excited to see that. And then the other news I would share is also from 9to5 Google, is that Minecraft has announced that there's a Chromebook-specific version of Minecraft coming to Chromebooks. Right now, the Android version works pretty darn well, but it is a more full-blown edition. The cost, I think it's like 20-something bucks, if I remember correctly. I'm sorry, $20 will be the price for that. What's interesting about this is that I'm sure that's of incredible interest to schools. And if you've been surviving on the Android version of it, it's functional, but not the full blown experience. And my other understanding from reading a lot of the coverage on this is that they don't promise feature parity with the Windows version of Minecraft yet, but they say that it should be only a month or two behind on feature upgrades from the Windows version. So those of you that are using Chromebooks and want to do something in the Minecraft world, this would be an incredible opportunity to do so.
Sounds good. All right. Why don't we talk a little bit about TikTok bans and social media, and then we have to talk a little bit of AI. Come on, we're going to be the AI show. We haven't even done AI yet.
I know.
We've made up for that though in the past month. So
yeah, ain't that the truth? So there are several articles. The one I shared, I didn't get a chance to talk about a couple weeks back, was that Montana is going to ban TikTok.
Joining 31 other states. I looked that up today. Evidently, 32 of 50 states has some kind of TikTok ban today. Yeah. I think that was, I'm surprised. I didn't know it was more than 50. I mean, more than half.
And despite it being a bipartisan thing nationally, it has been pushed more or less by the Republican Party in Montana. Has a supermajority here in both the House and Senate, and also the governor. Governor's seat is Governor Greg Gianforte is a Republican as well. And it's been a little more partisan here than it's been nationally. But if you look at the hearings last week, and I don't think I shared an article about the hearings.
I've got one
about the hearings last week. They were, I would call them bizarre, the national hearings last week. And one of the things that's really troubling about this is that it's really clear that a lot of our politicians, and this isn't necessarily a factor of age, I think it's a player in this, but I also think it's that our national political leaders don't seem to be all that tech savvy. Is the way I would describe it.
And what a scary thing in the age of AI.
Well, and that's part of the reason why, too, that, I mean, I do think we need to regulate tech, but regulating tech isn't about making sure there's a United States owner, although I will talk about that in a moment. I don't think TikTok, other than it's owned by an unfriendly government, right? Or at least there's access for an unfriendly government. I don't think TikTok does anything that's that unusual in comparison to other social media properties in the United States. And Al Franken made the joke. He hosted The Daily Show last week that we should be reserving stealing your private data for USA companies, right? And they started chanting USA, USA. It was pretty funny, but I think it illustrates part of the problem here that most politicians that are pretty fired up about TikTok, and this isn't a matter of party, this is just being a politician, seem to be generally very uninformed about the way technology works in 2023. And, as an example of that, you've probably seen the clip of there was a senator that was asking the CEO of TikTok about whether or not TikTok accesses your home Wi-Fi network. And the answer, of course, is yes, it does, right? Like, it has to get on the internet somehow. And if you're on a mobile device with a Wi-Fi connection, yes, it will access your Wi-Fi network. But so does Facebook, so does Google, so does every other tool that you use. I've also noticed, too, that, and there's been some coverage on this, that I'll give you an example of this. There's been a lot of people that have talked about how they feel like the Instagram and like properties are full of smut, for lack of a better word, right? And that they're constantly being fed inappropriate content. So when I first hear those arguments, I'm thinking to myself, well, you know, what is inappropriate content? And I've read several articles, and I looked for one tonight and couldn't find one that was articulating this as directly as this, is that a lot of those folks are probably getting smut, if you will, because they themselves are searching for smut, or at some point gave an indication to the algorithm that they were interested in such materials. And You know, and again, I'm not trying to blame the finger pointing here. I think it's a really complicated issue, but I am dramatically concerned that a lot of the folks that are pushing regulations on these companies are going to just try to ban TikTok or force its ownership to a US-based company without dealing with broader privacy implications that I think really are much more worth our time.
So I do have an article. This one is from Platformer, which is Casey Newton's publication. He's the one who does Hard Fork with Kevin Ruse of the New York Times. And his article is called How TikTok Failed to Make the Case. And he says three main things in terms of this testimony before Congress. And I certainly concur with you, Jason, that every opportunity that we see for lawmakers to interact with tech company CEOs and talk about these issues, that there's really not anything impressive that would, let us feel a lot of confidence about them, legislating on these issues. Casey Newton points out that really it was almost an impossible task. It was to prove a negative that no one's data has been misused. So that's a really, hard and difficult thing to do. There hasn't been much evidence of it. But the second thing he points out is that TikTok actually did surveil, U.S. journalists. And so that they didn't do themselves any favors with that. And then third, basically, I guess they're trying to say that they have meaningful independence from ByteDance, but it's just not. I think he was the one. There was a tech journalist, I think it was Casey, who got to go to the ByteDance headquarters and hear this kind of briefing. But I mean, like on the wall, it was sort of like there were Chinese flags, and this is a Chinese company. So I'm also very concerned. I mean, we have sadly a very long history of anti-Chinese laws as well as sentiments in the United States that go back, hundreds of years, and we certainly see, I think the United States and China, as well as with Russia, really facing off on the global stage in some much more hostile ways than we saw even 5 or 10 years ago. But it seems that, like you said, regardless of political party, it seems to be the fad du jour or whatever for lawmakers to be bad-mouthing TikTok, and it really didn't seem like this opportunity for the TikTok CEO to appear in front of Congress, won any points for them. So I don't know that he could have said anything that was going to help at this point. And it is really, I use this as a Wonderlink today with my two media literacy classes. And also we talked about the Utah law, and let me throw that out here. Because I think I put that in here. Maybe I didn't. Utah has just passed a law, which will take a year to go into effect, that will give parents, it'll put a curfew. So basically, you're going to have to prove that you're 18, not 13, but 18. Some analysts think with a driver's license, so that could have impacts for anonymity on the web. But if you're under 18, you're going to have a curfew that your social media programs will shut off and not work after like 10:30 at night or something. Parents are going to have access to all of your private messages, as well as all the content that you publish. Utah, the actual governor of Utah coincided made the timing of his announcement line up with the testimony of the ByteDance TikTok CEO, juxtaposing these two things. We've seen Europe with GDPR have privacy laws, and California has some privacy law. Tech companies certainly don't want to have a crazy kaleidoscope of laws that they're going to have to, rule on. And we've got, what is it, the 10th Amendment that talks about interstate commerce. I mean, usually when things cross state lines, the federal government steps in and regulates so that you don't have, 50 different rules that are affecting like a product that's being sold internationally. There are products here in terms of services and certainly things that are sold, via social media and these platforms, et cetera. So I, it's really It will almost certainly be challenged in court if that law, well, the law, it's a law now. It's not a bill. Utah has actually passed this law. The governor signed it. I think, and maybe I did. Maybe did I put it under the tech correction? Because that's where it belongs. Maybe I didn't. Okay. Yes. Vox. Utah's social media for kids law could be coming to a state near you. Actually, maybe you put that one in.
I did, but and it covers that in some detail. And the most stunning part about that, the article was pretty good, but also if you watch any of the national news media coverage, I mean, they brought in kids to testify about how terrible the influence of social media has been in their lives. And I will say, maybe controversially, that this would be less of a problem if we had taken on more responsibility in schools to help kids understand these technologies.
Perhaps, but I think we've also continued just to see the march of the attention economy, capitalism, you know, just and the power of these apps. And just like we were seeing in the ad center, you know, just a far reaching ability of technology companies to be able to keep track of each and every, you know, nudge that we have. So, yeah, this is appropriately under the tech correction. And I think that this Utah law, which is, again, not a bill, it is a law, really is in a category apart from the others. This isn't, you know, a governor like we had in Oklahoma say, no TikTok on state networks or whatever, and you've done that in Montana as well. This is something that would actually force the creators and designers of apps to design their apps differently as far as how they onboard users and then what they – and the fact that they're going to have you know, parental accounts, and those parental accounts are going to have, you know, access to the child accounts. And it's, I don't know that we've ever had anything like that. That's kind of unprecedented to have a state law saying, hey, developers of apps and websites, we're going to tell you how you have to design, you know, your app. And certainly we've had the whole thing about 13 and you know, it's supposed to be consent, but anyway, it's I think we'll talk about this some more because it's going to be challenged, and but I haven't read a legal opinion yet to know. I think we can safely say that there's going to be a lot of youth that are going to be quite offended, and there's even danger, right? I mean, there's youth that could be in danger if you know, parents had complete access to you know, their private messages and things like that. And I think I've said this to my students today. I think that all human beings have a right to privacy. You know, I think that is different in terms of parents, and those things get negotiated differently in families. But to think that, you know, just because you're under 18, you have no right to privacy is just like saying you don't have a right to life or a right to speech. You know, the Tinker decision. Hey, I'll cite my you know, law class that I did take in education, you know, says that the student's right to free speech doesn't end at the schoolhouse gate. If you're being disruptive to the educational process, why, then the school can step in. But the school does not have the ability to completely censor and stop you from having any kind of free speech rights at all, especially if you're, you know, not being disruptive to the educational activities that are taking place. So I think we're going to be talking about this a little bit more after tonight.
Yep. Hear. Well, Dr. Fryer, there's one article I want to mention about AI, and I think we could talk about it in greater detail next week because there's a lot of discussion here, but this is a bit of breaking news on AI. But in the last 24 hours, a lot of leaders in tech and elsewhere, including Elon Musk, have said that they would like us to pause, I believe it's for 6 months, on the continued development of AI technologies until we come out with rules and maybe more updated standards of what protections should be put into place. And the idea here is that 1,100 people that signed the letter said that it's going too quickly and that we need to stop it now before it gets out of our hands by putting more protections into place. And this letter was signed by some pretty heavyweights in the tech industry. Mr. Musk, I mentioned earlier, Steve Wozniak is on this list. Andrew Yang, former presidential candidate, is on this list. the CEO or the co-founder of Pinterest, the CEO of Getty Images is on here. Daniel Allen, who is a professor of the Edmund and Lilly Safford at Center for Ethics at Harvard, is on here. I mean, these are heavy hitters in tech and academia. And I have to say, I agree completely with this notion that I am super interested in the direction we're going in. And I'm even more interested now that I've had an opportunity to be in some rooms with some teachers in the last week to talk through this. There's a lot of interesting possibilities here, but let's be super frank about the situation. It is still a scary, scary time, and there's a lot of people that think this technology has the incredible potential to easily go rogue. And so I'll kind of leave that there. If you have any thoughts, Dr. Fryer, please.
Yeah, the velocity with which adoption of ChatGPT has happened with OpenAI is unprecedented. But the biggest thing is that we just don't understand it.
Yep.
And I tweeted to you on this one. There was a video by a red teaming member, somebody who was red teaming. His name is Nathan Lebanitz. He's on the Cognitive Revolution podcast. And the stuff that they have just at the very beginning of this saying, you know, the early version of ChatGPT had no guardrails. And so when he asked, how can I kill the most people? It didn't hesitate. It just gave a full on answer. Yeah. And so that's what so many people have been trying to do, is trying to push the guardrails and trying to, you know, figure out the limits and can you get it to do things that it's not supposed to do? And the answer appears to be yes, you know, it can. And so, my last thought, I listened to Ezra Klein. He recently did my thoughts on AI, and it's an article that he had written. He's a New York Times columnist, but he does his Ezra Klein podcast and then he does his columns. Well, he actually, I think, read an article. So I'll put that in the show notes. But what he said is he's had enough conversations with AI developers and really, really smart computer science folks who have talked about the fact that they do not understand fundamentally how all of this how this is working, but this is, they compare it to summoning an intelligence, which sounds fairly demonic. I mean, it is something that qualitatively feels different. And I think probably, Jason, you felt this. I certainly have when I've been interacting with it, that this is not Google. This is not a search engine. Nope. This is something really, really different and incredibly powerful. And so, like we know with basically every powerful technology and tool out there, it's going to be able to be used for good and for bad. And the idea of slowing down is what I've heard a number of people say. And like you said, this, you know, letter with Elon Musk and others signing on to it, I think makes a lot of sense, because it really seemed, I was shocked that Microsoft was so quick to hook ChatGPT up to the internet when I had heard, you know, employees of OpenAI say, we're, you know, keeping that away from the internet and, you know, really trying to protect that. And then boom, what does Microsoft do? Just immediately, hey, let's plug it into Bing so we can have a competitive advantage. It seemed irresponsible to me. And it does seem that Google is taking a more measured approach, you know, with Bard, but they still have a ton of pressure. It's that whole, you know, Sundar Pichai, code red, we've got to come up with a response. And so perhaps if we have this kind of pressure to slow down, that can help. But I think overall, the trajectory of where we're going is this technology is like, it's being birthed, right? It has been birthed and it is just going to get better and better. And so unfortunately, I do not see a prospect of this technology in the long term being kept out of the hands of bad actors and the guardrails being kept on. I don't see that. And I wish I could leave you with a more optimistic note, but yeah, it's hard to see how that is going to play out, you know, in a completely positive way.
Yeah. Well, and I would also say too that, well, earlier versions, I think, of OpenAI were open sourced. So, you know, in a lot of ways, the technology is out there, that could be a more dangerous version of it. Hey, I also would mention, Wes, that I did get in the beta of Google Bard. And I've been playing with it on and off. I would say it feels like a 6-month-old version of ChatGPT. It's also severely limited in the size of its both of its input and response, which makes it infinitely less useful to me. You know, it's all super interesting, but I think this will change education soon and forever. That's absolutely true. I wouldn't change that even if we slowed it down, but we absolutely have to be a little more thoughtful about where we're going here. And we can't wait around to regulate this like we did the internet and social media. In fact, we really haven't regulated either the internet or social media. 30 years after the internet became a thing and 20 years after social media became a thing. And we just can't wait around on AI. I'm sorry, but we can't.
What else? Of course, hey, we're going a little over time, but that's okay. In the Hard Fork podcast with Casey Newton and Kevin Ruse, one of the discussions that they had was talking about Bard and talking about this coming to Google, right? And yes, it's exciting to just interact with ChatGPT and ask it different questions. But when you think about your own data and hopefully being able to do this in a secure way, right? Hey, Bard, take every message that was written 3 years ago and older and archive that. Being able to do that in plain language. Bill Gates, I think in the last week, they published it's Behind the Tech and it's Microsoft's podcast with their CTO, and I've watched about half of it. Bill Gates, he's gotten a lot of things right. He's gotten a few things wrong, but he's a pretty smart guy. He really thinks that the predominant way that we're going to be interacting with our computers from now on is in natural language, which, with coding, it kind of sounds scary because of how context is so important and the precision that you need to have with coding. But when you think about these tools being embedded inside Gmail, inside Google Docs, inside Google Calendar, and the tools that we live with, and a lot of us do, we just live with these every single day, I think that is going to unleash some next level, wonderful constructive power and possibilities that's going to really be some productivity enhancements. And I really do look forward to that. But unfortunately, we're probably going to get the bad with the good. So Bard is, it's coming. But it'll be very, very interesting to see if we have any kind of regulatory response to this because, I don't know. Sometimes it takes a crisis in order to get regulation. And I think I heard someone this was talking about banking. This was another Ezra Klein, or maybe it was the Daily. It was a Daily podcast talking about, bank collapses and things in our monetary system, but saying, what has basically forced regulation in the past? It's been a big crisis. So hopefully it's not going to take that. But if you use history as a guide, we're probably going to have some kind of bad crisis happen and then say, oh, okay, I guess we need to have some regulation to stop this. But hey, maybe we'll have cooler heads prevail and folks will be able to put the brakes on stuff. But like you said, it's hard to see that this thing is going to slow down in the long term. And even if they try to do it for a little bit short term, I don't know what that looks like. Okay. Well, Dr. Neifer, you got a geek of the week for us.
I do, yeah. And of course, I've actually closed my window, which means I'm going to have to fill some time here while I bring this back up. But I know what it was.
Canva
last week announced more insanely cool tools, many of them backed by AI. And if you're a Canva user like I am, and by the way, Canva's revolutionized my workflow, right? I keep Canva up all day, every day. And, it's so improved the collaboration for visual design in my organization that I can't even begin to describe where to start. But they added in a bunch of wonderful new AI tools last week, and their presentation is called Canva Create. It's about an hour long. I think it's worth your time to watch it if you're a Canva user. So check it out. Really worth your time.
And I don't even use Canva. So what am I doing? I'm just lost over here.
Canva's amazing.
Okay, well, I should really just choose one, but I don't. In Machines We Trust, favorite podcast that I like to listen to, and they have been nominated as a New York Festival's finalist for this episode. The episode is called AI Births Digital Humans, and it was published today on March 29th. And so there are just all kinds of really, really powerful, you know, companies and technologies that are discussed in that podcast. I really recommend it. InteriorAI.com will let you take a picture of any room in your house, Jason, and then ask it to visualize a different style. And that is just a really, really cool thing that I haven't tested yet. I was going to test it before the show. And then lastly, yes, I did put it in. I've only watched about, I don't know, about 20 minutes of this. But this is OpenAI's ChatGPT discussion with Red Teamer, Nathan Lebanitz, and Eric Torenberg. And that was the show that I was actually just talking about, where they discuss what it was like to interact with the unguardrail, non-guardrail version of ChatGPT-4. And will we be able to keep the guardrails on? Probably not, but it remains to be seen. Where can folks find you, Dr. Neifer, when you're not giving a keynote at NCCE or showing up here on Wednesday nights and showing off your large book collection in your office?
Sure. I really probably need to get back to where I have a website again. I took it down, and I think I'm redirecting Neifer.com to my LinkedIn profile. So at some point I'll have Neifer.com/after, which is Dr. Fryer's great strategy. But best place to find me is probably Twitter, TechSavvyTeach. I'm also on Mastodon at knife@mastodon.cloud.
Yes, you can go to westfryer.com/after and find lots of links, but I have decided at this point to not leave Twitter, so W. Fryer, but I'm so cross-posting to Mastodon. Because, by the way, we didn't get to the article, and sign up for our Substack, by the way, because you can get an email with all those articles that we not only talked about but did not talk about. Advertisers are not coming back to Twitter. So if Twitter doesn't make money, it ain't going to survive. But anyway, but things do go through bankruptcy and they still live on, and Twitter is such an important thing. It's hard to imagine it completely going away, but still enjoying Mastodon, but that's, I'm not planning an exodus there. So this has been the EdTech Situation Room. We are a weekly, almost weekly Wednesday show. Sometimes we take a week off, but usually we're here. And we love to get feedback. So if you've listened to the show, whether you have joined us live or you've checked us out after the fact, you can always find small 32 kilobit MP3 audio versions at our website, edtechsr.com, as well as approximately 100 meg compressed video versions. But those are easy to find on Facebook as well as YouTube. And you can generally find us, we think, anywhere your podcasts are curated. So we want to thank everybody for your contributions and for your interactions with us. Congratulations again to Dr. Neifer for a fantastic keynote, which we hope is, you know, there's more to come, because his wisdom... not many folks get a standing ovation for their keynote. So that's a good sign. So congrats. And until next time, we encourage you to stay savvy and stay safe. We'll see you next time on the EdTech Situation Room.
Good night, all.